Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Right now on Last Call, from bad to worse, a top safety official making a shocking new claim about Boeing. The first currency crisis blamed on crypto. A wild story unfolding in one major nation with one detained American. Oil spiking, Ukrainian attacks against Russian refineries rocking energy. We're going to show you what may come next. Has commercial real estate bottomed out? Why one major Wall Street bank may be suddenly jumping in? Plus, end of the road? A once high-flying EV maker nosediving after hours. And a royal frenzy. Just how obsessed are you about Kate Middleton and the mystery of where she is? Well, we've got hard data on just that. All that and more over the hour. So as always, belly up, buckle up. Last Call is up right now. Well, good evening here. Good afternoon out west, everybody. I am Brian Sullivan. Hi. We've got all that and more coming up in our hour. But first up on Last Call, is it time's up for TikTok? The House overwhelmingly passing a bill that could end up banning TikTok. The bipartisan legislation is officially called the Protecting Americans from Foreign Adversary-Controlled Applications Act. Quite the mouthful. It, quote, prohibits distributing, maintaining, or providing internet hosting services from a foreign adversary-controlled application. The bill specifies that foreign-owned apps have 6 months to divest or face a nationwide ban. The legislation now heads to the Senate, where a vote is yet to be scheduled. The White House, though, today urging the Senate to, quote, take swift action. Again, at issue is TikTok's China-linked parent company, ByteDance. TikTok officially is headquartered in Los Angeles, but its parent company is based in China. And lawmakers say that relationship is a national security concern, TikTok obviously disputing those claims. Some critics of the bill worry that its rather open-ended text seemingly leaves the door open to targeting other foreign-owned apps, maybe like Temu, the popular China-owned e-commerce company, which is the third most popular shopping site now in America, according to ComScore. So are the critics correct about so-called mission creep, or is potential ban really the right move? Let's take it to our all-star panel to kick off the show tonight and discuss. Mountain CEO Mark Douglas and founder and president of EMJ Capital, Eric Jackson. Eric, a lot of people are suggesting this because the language, this could be viewed as kind of a Trojan horse to shutting down other applications or even other websites. As an investor, what do you make of it?
I think that this is a lot of talk. But I'm not convinced, Brian, that this is actually going to be taken swiftly up by the Senate and actually put into law. Should it be put into law? Yeah, it probably should. I see how much my kids are on it. Multiply that across America, giving access to the Chinese government, all that information. Yeah, probably should. But I think this is going to be like a Tipper Gore type of moment where, you know, Tipper wanted to ban rap music because she thought it was harmful for kids. Kids kind of rose up against that. They weren't going to have that. They were going to get what they want to get. I think there's going to be a lot of pushback on this. I think the Senate is likely to back down, just like we have backed down over however many times we've talked about banning TikTok up till now. And I think this gets killed.
Well, we'll see. Mark, though, you would make the point, I think, that it's pretty easy to shut something off in another country. I mean, China can shut off our applications in 2 seconds if they wanted to. In China, we could probably do the same. So I think your point is that because this bill gives time for them to change, they really don't maybe want it banned.
Yeah, so actually your point, they could ban Google, Gmail, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, probably CNBC are all banned in China. If you go to China, I've been to Beijing, you can't access any of these apps. So this is not really that unusual. All of these American apps are banned in China. Now, in terms of the bill itself, the bill provides 6 months to basically either figure out a new structure, what's called, you know, sell to a U.S. company or something of that nature, or it gets banned, which I think means there's not an expectation TikTok will actually be shut down. If the Senate passes the bill, and I think the smart move would be for them to pass the bill, that then starts a six-month clock to negotiate a new structure for how TikTok operates in the U.S. I do not see a day where TikTok is actually shut down. Oh. And that's the smart way to do it, is to figure out a better approach over those 6 months.
Well, so Mark, back to you, because you're a marketing guy, right? There's so much money going on to TikTok and ads, and people are making livings, in some cases making millions probably off TikTok. Would you advise your clients or advertisers to stay away then from TikTok even now? Because they don't want to pour a bunch of money at something that may be shut down in a couple of months, I don't think.
No, I think the kinds of advertisers, what we call performance advertisers or direct response advertisers, they review where they're allocating their budgets literally every week. It's like investment managers on Wall Street. So they only need to know a week out if they're not going to be able to advertise on TikTok. And they will keep going as long as they're getting a good return on that ad investment right up to the very end. They're not looking at it like a year in advance like big brand advertisers do.
Eric, do you worry that China, I know you don't think it's going to ultimately be banned, but let's say it is. Okay, let's say it gets through, the president signs it, TikTok is done. Do you worry that China's government then could take some kind of retaliation or retaliatory tone with tariffs or export restrictions or something else on us? Or is TikTok not that big, not that relevant?
I think for sure there would be retaliation, Brian. I think, and probably the two companies most likely to be affected would be Apple and Tesla. I mean, what if the Chinese government said Apple and Tesla had to divest of their Chinese operations along with any IP associated with it? Obviously, that would, you know, cause a huge brouhaha. But that would be, I expect, coming down the line. So investing in Chinese stocks, you asked about that earlier, Brian. I mean, It's a really, you know, I'd advise lots of investors to just stay away because you just never know when you're going to wake up and there's some headline overnight that has totally whacked the sector.
Yeah.
The sector has been kind of a tough one to invest in over the last 3 years. So you're just taking on a lot of macro risk when you buy into these individual names.
Follow up on that, Eric, because I think you make a great point. I'm not advocating for or against the bill, but to your point, the Chinese government has already effectively banned use of the iPhone by China government employees. I could see a situation, just knowing China's history, where they say, listen, the iPhone is really a data collection device for the American government. Tesla, it's a data collection device for, you know, Tesla and thus the American government. And thus we're going to ban those products.
Well, they're already, you know, they've already insisted that the cloud servers for both those companies be based in China. So, and there was a lot of complaining at the time when that happened because, you know, who has access to that data? Obviously, the Chinese government. So, I mean, Apple and Tesla are walking this line right now between commerce, you know, and giving up information and privacy to do business over there. So, this is happening. Nobody should be surprised about it. And it will continue to go on this way.
All right. Well, you guys are 2-0 in the it eventually does not get banned camp. We're going to find out what happens. Stranger things have occurred. Mark and Eric, thank you both very much. All right. Let's take a look at what happened to your money today. And it was really a mixed bag. The Dow rose a whopping 37 points. The other indexes fell slightly. Onto your stud and dud of the day, the big winner of the day, copper. And gold miner Freeport-McMoRan up 7.5%. Copper prices hitting a more than one-year high. Keep in mind, that will keep the cost of electrification going up. The big decliner, Dollar Tree, down 14% after announcing it would close nearly 1,000 stores. The company citing inflation and theft as the reason. All right, quick check on futures. They are all slightly in the green right now. Well, we are just getting started here on Last Call and On Deck. It could be the most stunning revelation yet from Boeing's onslaught of problems. And that's saying something. And later, it may be the first currency crisis triggered by crypto. The unbelievable story developing out of one major crypto country ahead.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
CNBC has quick and easy to understand business news updates at the open, midday, and close every weekday. Markets, money, and more from Wall Street to Main Street. I'm CNBC's Jessica Ettinger. Follow and listen to CNBC Business News Updates wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, let's get to tomorrow's news tonight. Some of the stories and headlines you and Wall Street will be talking about tomorrow morning. First up, Under Armour founder Kevin Plank is returning to the company in the CEO role. He will succeed current CEO Stephanie Linnartz on April 1st. Mohamed El-Arian, the guy you know well, CNBC viewer, will take over Plank's current board position as chairman of the board. Congratulations to Mohamed El-Arian. Shares initially surging after hours, but have come back down since. Next up, Marlboro maker Altria is planning to sell 35 million shares of Anheuser-Busch InBev. Altria currently holds 197 million shares, representing about 10% ownership of InBev. The sale announcement sending Bud shares into the red in extended hours. Obviously, just more sellers than buyers. Moving on, traders on Robinhood can't get enough equity trading, apparently. Volumes rose to $80.9 billion in February, up just over 40% from last year. Crypto trading volumes jumped to $6.5 billion, about a 90% jump year over year. Investors are pleased with those big numbers. Robinhood shares are surging right now, up 10%. And finally, according to the Wall Street Journal, electric vehicle startup Fisker is preparing for a possible bankruptcy. Now, once upon a time, Fisker held nearly $8 billion in value. It has since lost pretty much all of it and continuing that decline right now, falling about 50% to just a couple cents a share. Let's bring in Phil LeBeau for more. Phil, what is your take? Fisker's had problems for a while financially. Yep. We know that. What is your take? And do we know if the company will stop? Will cars still be rolled out?
Well, they've got inventory of some vehicles. Whether or not they're able to sell those or they stay in business, that remains to be seen, Brian. Look, a couple of weeks ago, they reported their Q4 results, and at the time, they issued what they call a going concern warning, essentially saying they had substantial doubt about the ability to stay in business. They did about just under $300 million in sales and revenue last year. They've got $1 billion in debt. They have not been able to hit their production targets nor their sales targets. And they're really getting hit with a couple of big things going against them right now. First of all, they didn't start rolling out until June when the EV market started slowing down. You put on top of that, these are higher priced vehicles, and that high end of the EV market is not selling real well right now. People want something more affordable. And remember, these are manufactured in Graz, Austria. I've been to the plant. I was there when they rolled out the first model. And if you have a vehicle that is not built in the U.S., an EV, you're not going to qualify for the EV tax credits. So all of those things, put those together, along with the fact that it's such low volume, this is a trying time for whether or not Fisker can survive this. They are in conversations with some investors or potentially other automakers. But you have to ask yourself, Brian, this is an asset-light company. What they really have is their IP and their designs. And the question is, does somebody see some value there if Fisker cannot restructure and stay in business on its own?
And Fisker filed for bankruptcy a number of years ago when they had the Fisker Karma. Correct?
When it was Fisker Automotive, yeah.
Yeah. All right, I want to turn now to Boeing. Boeing's PR trouble continues. A letter from the NTSB revealing that the airplane maker apparently, did not retain key video of repairs on the door and the door plug that eventually blew out of that Alaska Airlines flight. So, Phil, I think what we're hearing is that some people are saying that Boeing kind of disappeared the maintenance video.
Well, it depends on who you listen to about this. The NTSB sent a letter. The chair of the NTSB, Jennifer Homendy, sent a letter to members of Congress saying, look, the video showing the work when this plane was manufactured in November, that video has been overwritten. We reached out to Boeing, and Boeing issued a statement saying, wait a second, our security video, which is what this would be, it re-records every 30 days, which is not unusual, Brian. That happens with a lot of companies. And remember, this was at the beginning of November. By early December, when it, you know, they re-racked and started rolling again on the security footage, this plane was in service. There was no indication something was wrong here. In the letter to Congress, Jennifer Homendy writes, releasing investigative information without context, and she's talking about Boeing releasing information publicly, is misleading the Congress and the public and undermines both the investigation and the integrity of the NTSB. This gets back to the point that the NTSB chair has been making in the past, saying Boeing is talking about this investigation while it's still going on and it should not be doing that. Well, when you look at things from the perspective of Boeing, they sit there and they believe, look, we are simply sharing the information and being as forthright as possible about what's happening here. The NTSB, by the way, has set August hearing dates for the MAX door plug investigation. So it's a long ways off, and their investigation is nowhere close to being finished. By the way, when we reached out to Boeing for its comment about the latest from the NTSB and the comments from Chair Homendy, they said, we will continue supporting this investigation in the transparent and proactive fashion we have supported all regulatory inquiries into this accident. We have worked hard to honor the rules and the release of investigative information. Bottom line is this, Brian. The last thing that Boeing needs right now is to be seen as either withholding information or going back and forth with the NTSB. But that's what's happening here. And you could sit there and say, well, Boeing should be more forthright. Boeing's response is, look, the video was not overwritten. The video was not there. And we are sharing the information as requested by the NTSB.
So I just want to clear it up. So Boeing is saying the video just never existed, or Boeing is saying it's likely that because they recycle the videos every Thursday, 30 days, that it just kind of got over-recorded,
like
but
secure,
there's no conspiracy
like
or cover-up here.
Brian, just so you know, it's like most security camera footage. It's never kept. Rarely do you come across an entity, a company, that keeps security footage forever. Typically, security footage is re-racked and it's taped over every 30 days, unless there is an incident or something happens. Remember, this plane was manufactured in October and in early November. Go 30 days from there. You're now looking at the beginning of December, even the middle of December. This incident didn't happen until January 5th, almost two 30-day cycles. So that's what Boeing is saying, is that it is typical for security camera footage to be re-racked, and you just continue taping it over and over, unless some incident says, stop it, let's hold it.
Maybe you got a screen grab or something. Who knows these days? Phil LeBeau, two interesting stories. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right, still ahead. A currency crisis apparently sparked by Bitcoin. An unbelievable situation is playing out right now in one major African nation, and people are being detained. That story ahead.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you. Like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively FedEx.
Snazzy new animation. All right, let's get to our last call watch list. And tonight it's all about Bitcoin. First off, Bitcoin hit another record today, over 73,000. Bitcoin has more than doubled in value in just 4 months. But while Bitcoin continues to print money for investors, a very different type of crypto story is playing out in Africa. Listen to this. Two senior employees from Singapore-based crypto firm Binance have been detained and are under custody in Nigeria. Their families tell the Wall Street Journal that they'll remain under detention at least through next week, waiting on a court decision. Both have not been charged with any crimes, at least not yet. However, the Nigerian government is accusing the crypto exchange in part for wrecking their local currency. The Nigerian currency is one of the worst performers in the world. Over the past year, it has lost 70% of its value relative to the U.S. dollar. So you see, Nigerians have been flocking to crypto to shelter their savings from the plunging currency and a soaring inflation rate, which hit nearly 30% 2 months ago. Other sub-Saharan nations like South Africa and Kenya have also seen a rise in crypto transactions, people buying it because their actual currency, if not worthless, is becoming nearly worthless. So is Nigeria just using Bitcoin as a scapegoat, or will crypto cause currency crises in other developing nations? Let's talk about it with CNBC technology reporter Mackenzie Sigalos, who was recently in Nigeria covering crypto, and former Binance chief strategy officer Patrick Hillman. Mackenzie, first to you. Most people are probably hearing this story for the very first time. So it's just kind of in a basic way, what's going on?
So 3 weeks ago when all of this started, I was in Africa, and the conversation was really around whether this was a wider crackdown by Nigeria on crypto or if this was about singling out a bad actor. And the consensus kind of converged on the fact that this is really about singling out a player, Binance. It's now an easy target. They recently settled with the U.S. government for $4.3 billion to avoid further repercussions in the United States. And what you're looking at is these two officials who are being held are essentially functioning as leverage, because Nigeria says that they want information on the top 100 traders in Nigeria using Binance's platform and their full transaction history for the last 6 months. And as you said, neither of these employees has been charged. And interestingly, neither really has any decision-making power. So I will say this, even though it does seem to be that they're targeting Binance here, it's also not a good look for Nigeria. It doesn't really say I'm open for business. And it certainly has a chilling effect in terms of foreign investment.
Yeah, and Patrick, I want to make it clear to our audience that you do not represent Binance in any way. You used to work there. You no longer do. I got that out of the way. To Mackenzie's point, it sounds like this could have happened to any crypto person. It just happened to Binance employees. Do you think that the Nigerian government is trying in some ways to scapegoat crypto for the fact that their policies have caused the collapse of their own currency?
Well, look, let's be really frank here. The facts are really easy to identify. When the Tinubu regime decided to float the Naira from the U.S. dollar, to float it from the peg, the value of the Naira dropped 29% in just 24 hours, which basically sent their currency into free fall. So what do you do if you're Nigerian? You move your money into any other currency you can that's more stable. So their first stop was to go to the U.S. dollar, but then the regime decided to restrict access to the U.S. dollar, which is what sent Nigerians fleeing to crypto stablecoins. So this is in no way a reflection or a response to crypto being actively traded in the country. This is an attempt by a government to try and deflect from what was a very poor monetary decision in order to hopefully try and circumvent any sort of political repercussions of this. And to Mackenzie's point, this looks like a state-sponsored kidnapping. These two employees have absolutely no authority over their employer's the processes mm-hmm. and regulations in any region, let alone Nigeria's. They were welcomed to come to this meeting by the regime themselves. And once they arrived, based on reporting, they were apprehended and have been held against their will in an undisclosed government location. So, this has all of the markings of a failed government that is doing everything it possibly can to try and avoid any sort of little political repercussions for their own negative monetary policy.
But Mackenzie,
Brian, one other
go ahead.
Point here. If you, the Nigerian government has also taken issue with Binance's peer-to-peer market. They were afraid that there was collusion happening with traders in order to skew the price of the Naira when they were going in and out of U.S. dollar peg stablecoins. So that also was a part of the calculus here, Brian.
Well, Mackenzie, you were there, and obviously Nigeria, mostly well-known for oil. It's about 70% of their GDP. Nigeria is one of the most wealth unequal countries in the world. There are a tiny group of people who are incredibly wealthy, and the majority of the rest of the nation lives in abject poverty. There's basically no middle class in Nigeria. And I wonder if, because you were just there, I wonder if this is sort of an effort to calm any public outcry, because my guess is the folks that are buying the crypto in the first place are from that first group of the wealthier that I just mentioned, while the rest of the nation has to suffer with a currency that it's not quite there yet, but may literally be not worth the paper it is printed on.
Yeah, if you look at the dynamic since the pandemic, the peg to the U.S. dollar used to be 360 naira. It's now north of 1600. As you said, there are a lot of the wealth disparity is just tremendous in the country right now. And so crypto in general is an easier scapegoat. That being said, this narrative that Nigeria is cracking down on crypto just isn't right. You saw the central bank, which has historically been pretty hostile to the sector, actually ease up on its policy in December, saying that banks could now work with crypto entities. The SEC in Nigeria in February began accepting applications from these virtual asset service providers. So there does seem to be this changing dynamic under the new president who just took power last January. So that's one thing that's at play here. But as you said, there is so much wealth that is fleeing into crypto because people want some form of dollar exposure, and they're getting that through USD peg stable coins like Tether.
Yeah, it's good stuff. It's a scary story. Let's hope these folks are indeed returned home soon. Not arrested yet. I guess they're not in a jail. They're in like home detention, but still not where any of us would want to be. Patrick and Mackenzie, thank you both very much. By the way, a Binance spokesperson sent us the following statement regarding the situation in Nigeria. Quote, while it is inappropriate for us to comment on the substance of the claims, at this time, we could say that we are working collaboratively with Nigerian authorities to bring Nadim and Tigran back home safely to their families. They are professionals with the highest integrity, and we will provide them with all the support we can. We trust there will be a swift resolution to this matter. All right, now let's get to our quicker than the ticker. All the best of the rest of the headlines.
Let's put 60 seconds on the clock. $1.3 billion lost last year to scammers. That's according to new FBI data. The agency received more than 50,000 reports of tech support and government impersonation scams. Waymo officially launching robo-taxi service in Los Angeles. It's called Waymo One, and it will offer rides across 63 square miles. One catch, though, no freeways. Neil Young back on Spotify. Remember, the singer took his music off the platform, protesting Joe Rogan's podcast episodes about COVID. Billboard Music estimates Young's protest costing him $16,000 in royalties every month. Chick-fil-A prioritizing mobile pickup. The restaurant is testing a new concept that is mobile order pickup only. No dine-in, no seating, no menus. First location to open in New York City later this month. And you ever want to smell like French fries? No? Well, McDonald's Japan is doing it anyway, unveiling a fragrance line of savory scents. Oh, over already.
And those are the flavor of fries at McDonald's in Japan. Which one would you want to smell like? All right, on deck. Bottoming out, a major Wall Street bank is diving back into commercial real estate. Is the worst finally over? That's next. Time for your RBI, and it's a perfect occasion to remember one of the great pieces of investing advice, or multiple ones, courtesy of one Warren Buffett, who said, quote, be fearful when others are greedy, and greedy when others are fearful. Or maybe, how about famed banker Baron de Rothschild, who more bluntly put it, the time to buy is when there's blood in the streets. Now, if you had heeded that advice, not blood in the streets, but you get it, 1 year ago tonight, you'd be sitting pretty. You may remember the markets were in pretty rough place back then because the fallout from the Silicon Valley bank collapse was rippling across the financial sector, and beyond fear, volatility, they were rampant. But in reality, exactly 1 year ago, stocks hit their multi-year bottom amid that crisis. The S&P 500 is now up more than 34% since then. And if you had bought J.P. Morgan Chase, arguably the key player in helping to calm the turmoil, you'd be up by more than 45%. Opportunity, it seems, rarely knocks twice, but if you timed it, congratulations, that was random but profitable. All right, speaking of beaten down groups, for the commercial real estate sector, the bottom may be near, at least maybe, according to Goldman Sachs. At a property conference in France, executives from Goldman's asset management arm told Reuters that they feel like the market is bottoming out and that now is a chance to buy. Still, other investors at the conference were more skeptical. Remember, the national office vacancy rate hit a record high at the end of just last year. So who may have it right? Joining us now is a board member of the New York Fed. Oh, also the CEO of RXR Realty, Scott Reckler. Scott, listen, Goldman's not always right. But if Goldman is starting to get a little more bullish about commercial real estate, at least in some areas, shouldn't we be?
Hey, Brian, great to be here. I would say this is just the beginning of the process. You know, I think we went through a period in the commercial real estate space, you know, since rates began to rise of these sort of five stages of grief. And we were through denial and then depression in 23 that sort of caused a period of where people were paused and waiting to see what happened. And now we're at acceptance. And I think in acceptance, then we need to accept that values are going to be lower. And I think the where people are investing, like RXR is investing, and you hear Goldman, is we're selectively finding the spots where people have capitulated to where values make sense to buy in these current market conditions. But, you know, in a world where we're going to have rates higher for longer, which seems to be the case right now, that would imply that commercial real estate is going to be under more stress, not less stress. And this stress is not something that happens overnight. This is not a V-shaped recovery. This is as loans mature at lower rates that need to be refinanced at higher rates, at lower values, and then when they were originally refinanced, they need to be recapitalized. And that's the opportunity. And it's, I would say it's not a macro play. It's not something like going to go bet an index. This is a stock picker play. You got to pick the right property, the right sector, the right market. You not only have to have capital, you have to have the right conviction and the right capabilities to understand where those opportunities are.
But will it turn into the sort of the economic tsunami that some were talking about a couple of years ago? I mean, $2.2 trillion, Scott, even these days, is a big number.
Yeah, as I said, I think we're really at the beginning of what's going to be a elongated process. And I think the question that we have to ask ourselves is have the investors and lending institutions really mark the value of their loans and their investments to where they're going to trade. And as we start seeing transaction activity start happening, valuations will crystallize and those marks will start coming down. I mean, you saw it with New York Community Bank, right? They had loans on their books. You know, there was $18 billion of New York City regulated multifamily. What's the value of that in today's world? What's the value of Class B commercial office space in the Sunbelt region where you have all this multifamily that's been developed? You know, there's going to be a surge of supply. And there was an extensive amount of loans that were done on floating rate debt at a point where cap rates were low, interest rates were low, rents were going higher. And now rents are coming down and cap rates and interest rates are higher. So there's a lot of dislocation in the market that it's going to play itself out, I think, really, you know, throughout 2025, at least.
Do you think that what's happening with New York Community Bank, I know it's isolated, I get that. It wasn't a year ago, but it feels that way now, at least for now, Scott. Will that have ripple effects in commercial real estate at all, or do you think it's just kind of its own thing?
Listen, I think we can't keep saying that every time a bank fails, it's an isolated, unique circumstance, right?
It doesn't feel like that.
Right. There's financial shocks when you have interest rates rise as quickly as they have and as high as they have and stay as high as they are for as long as they're staying. And I think when the other pro-cyclical factor here is when you have things like New York Community Bank happen, regulators get much more focused on the loans on other books of other banks' books. And so they're going to be much more critical of those loans. So I would anticipate seeing more banks run into challenges and have to shed some of their real estate loans. I'd also anticipate, you know, banks having to not only be more bank failures, mm-hmm. but a lot of consolidation of the smaller banks. And you could see 500 fewer banks or more between now and the end of 25.
Many people have said that it's tough, but there are simply too many banks in the United States. Let's hope commercial real estate has found some kind of a bottom. Scott Reckler, RXR, do appreciate it. Thank you. All right, coming up, Ukraine taking the fight into Russia, blasting some massive oil refineries. The real world impact coming up. Well, I got a bonus TNT for you right now. TikTok CEO moments ago putting out a new video on, well, where else? TikTok. As we covered earlier, the House voted in favor of a bill today that would force parent company ByteDance to divest TikTok or face an American ban. And here's how TikTok CEO is responding.
We will not stop fighting and advocating for you. We will continue to do all we can, including exercising our legal rights to protect this amazing platform that we have built with you.
Now, of course, TikTok could just move its servers to the United States. And I mean, that would be pretty easy, but okay, they're not. Anyway, TikTok either way shows no sign of backing down. Meantime, Ukraine not backing down either. It is fighting back and it is trying to hit Putin where it hurts. His wallet. Ukraine targeting and striking at least three refineries in Russia over the last 2 days. Those refineries combined account for about 12% of Russia's oil processing capacity. Oil prices did rise a bit on the news. But given that it's Russia, it's hard to gauge the real extent of any damage. So let's find out what we may be able to know based on data and just what we know. Joining us now is Rapidan Energy Group Global Oil Service Director Clay Siegel. Clay, you kind of track oil flows for a living. It's Russia. We're not getting a lot of information. We see some rough video. What do we know?
Hey, Brian, it's good to be with you. And apologies if I look sleepier than usual. I was up overnight, not just last night, but now two nights running, where we've seen a really concerted effort by the Ukrainian armed forces to ramp up the pressure by sending these long-range strike drones deep into Russian territory to hit these faraway refineries with really impressive, from a military and oil standpoint, results. And so they have crippled up to getting close to 1 million barrels per day of refinery throughput in these four Russian refineries that were hit. The first one, Tuapse, around the Black Sea in January, and then the next three that you just referenced over the last 2 days. And so the losses are adding up for Russia. And now it has kind of a dual problem, a double trouble on the oil side, because it's going to be left with too much crude oil and not enough of the important transportation fuels like gasoline and diesel. And those have the ability to impact faraway markets, including over here.
Yeah. And by the way, this was one attack or a couple of attacks, a couple of drones, and we're talking about it, but it shows what Ukraine wants to do. And I'm just a little bit surprised the oil market is not reacting more to the idea that, well, if they can do it once or twice, they can probably do it more than that. And one wonders if Ukraine just keeps doing this, then what happens?
Well, that's it. I mean, when we talk about the world of oil disruptions, we're always thinking about two things. We're thinking about the volumes that are taken offline, and we're talking about the duration. How long is it going to continue? Now, when it comes to these attacks, you could say our forecast is partly to mostly explosive, because we have 80% odds that the Ukrainians will be successful in continuing to target Russian refineries and put these explosive targets on point. And so, but in a way, like, I don't think people should really be surprised about this, because countries at war have been attacking each other's energy resources, and particularly oil, for more than a century now. It goes all the way back, you're a history guy, goes all the way back to the time between the world wars, when oil became the dominant fuel of the world's militaries. So World War II, Korea, Vietnam, the more modern Gulf Wars, and even the war against ISIS, all featured one or more sides trying to deprive the other of oil resources. And so that's the fuel that you need to fight the war, to keep the society going at home. It's no surprise to see it happening in this war.
No, I remember my grandfather, before he died, was telling me stories about him and the Patton's Third Army in the Ardennes passing tank after tank after tank that didn't work because they ran out of fuel. You got to kind of love it, right? Ukraine stepping up, smacking it down. You just wonder, if they keep these attacks up, what is the risk to oil prices?
Well, oil prices can definitely tick higher. Let's take diesel, first of all, because I think it's the biggest one for energy markets at risk. Diesel prices are already a bit higher than they were. They've been elevated because we have low stocks in the United States, in Europe. Activity in China for diesel is starting to pick up. And then you have the whole Red Sea situation, which is requiring much longer transit of oil from east to west. We've talked about that on the show before. And so diesel is already moving into kind of a low supply state in a couple of regions. If you then take out a quarter million barrels a day of diesel supply from Russia, even though the EU, the European Union countries don't import it directly, it's still important for global supplies. And if you take that oil off the market, prices stand to go higher from here.
Yeah. Still even prices go higher, it's still nice to see Ukraine just fighting back and hitting Putin maybe where it hurts. Clay Siegel, Rapidan Energy. Clay, thank you. All right, coming up, admit it. Just admit it. It's all you can talk about. It's all you can think about. What is going on with Princess of Wales, Kate Middleton? Some eye-opening data shows how obsessed we have all become, and we'll bring it to you next. All right, we're going to get a quick check on the futures, and you can see they're all in the green. Not a lot, but it indicates tomorrow could be yet another record day for the U.S. equity markets. We've already had 17 record highs this year, the most ever, going back to 1998 for a first quarter. That's like a bonus RBI. All right, it is the story that is captivating the U.K., us, and much of the world. Where is Princess of Wales, Kate Middleton? She has done no public events since Christmas Day. She went to the hospital mid-January. Since then, a doctored photo of her and her kids sparked a wildfire after it was found to be, well, doctored. And the royal family issued what's called a kill notice to the media, basically in no way ever do not use, well, that picture. Publications and social media cannot get enough of the story. Speculation into the well-being and whereabouts of the future Queen of England are at a fever pitch. But just how much of this so-called Kate-gate is fueling media consumption right now? Well, our next guest has the answer. Let's bring in Zeta Global CEO David Steinberg. They use AI-powered software to identify data trends. And it's not a light story because we don't know where the Princess of Wales is. And some of the numbers on the public interest are stunning, David.
Stunning, Brian. First of all, thank you for having me. I mean, we're seeing a tsunami of information here. To put it in perspective, since the beginning of the year, when we first heard about her surgery, we heard about it on January 16th, she has had 276,000 articles written about her. To put it in perspective, in that exact same period, President Biden and Donald Trump have had a combined 101,000. So you're talking almost three times the attention of, you know, the two gentlemen getting and winning and securing their nominations.
That is amazing. That articles about Kate Middleton, I understand it's more of a global phenomenon than our election is, but there are more than twice as many as Trump and Biden combined. And by the way, the Kate Middleton story is kind of relatively new-ish. The intrigue really just kind of firing up over the last couple of weeks. I think that makes it even more staggering.
100%. I mean, put it in perspective. I mean, we all know who Biden and Trump are. We've known them for many, many years. Literally, Kate's attention is up 206% month over month for 2 months. You're talking almost 400% up since January 16th, when Buckingham Palace announced that she had had a successful surgery. There was sort of no notice about it. We didn't know it was coming. It wasn't like a royal wedding where we knew for months that it was coming. This just spiked.
And seems to be growing by the day. But it's important to note, David, that according to your AI data, the Princess of Wales, and let's hope that everything turns out to be just fine, is still nowhere near Taylor Swift.
No, T. Swift is the undisputed champ of the internet, as is her boyfriend for football. But you're talking, once again, 276,000 for Kate Middleton since the beginning of the year. Joe Biden and Donald Trump, 101,000. Taylor Swift, 19 million in that exact same period. So we all know where everybody's bread is buttered, and it's definitely around Taylor Swift.
Yes, she's the undisputed queen or king of anything. And let's hope we find out what happened to the Princess of Wales soon, David. It's a weird story getting weirder by the day. We appreciate you coming on to break down the numbers, David. Thank you very much. All right, you know what happened 38 years ago today? A little tiny old company made its Wall Street debut. It's called Microsoft, founded, yep, in Albuquerque, New Mexico. It priced at $21 a share back in 1986, and Microsoft finished the trading day up 30%. A year later, a guy named Bill Gates became a millionaire. At the time, he was the youngest to ever become a millionaire. And of course, he went on to become much, much richer. Everybody, or a billionaire, excuse me, what's a millionaire? It's a billionaire, of course. We'll see you tomorrow night, everybody. Shark Tank is next.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.